This week on Crossing the Line, I'll speak to Rania Nasri, assistant professor on the Faculty of Science at the University of Balamon in Lebanon, about the current situation in the country following the assassination of Pierre Jamail and the fallout from the war with Israel. Then later in the program, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal and a special weekly segment entitled The War's Toll, compiled and read by Scott Bergwin of the Stand Independent News Service. All this coming up. But first, a look back at the week's news in Palestine, reported by Kristen S.
From the Palestine News Network, I'm Kristen S. with This Week in Review for the 15th through the 21st of December, 2006. This week, President Abbas was considered to have staged an effective coup by not abiding Palestinian basic law and calling for early elections, which means that the Hamas party, who won the legitimate elections in January, is out. Neither the Fatah party nor the Hamas party could agree on necessary points for the government of national unity that both are still hoping for. Prime Minister Haniyeh's car was attacked when he was returning from his Middle East meeting tour through the Rafah crossing with Egypt. One of his guards was killed and his son and another man were injured. Some pointed the finger at Fatah official Mohammed Dahlan for the assassination attempt. Since then, the Hamas executive forces, run by the Ministry of Interior, and members of PA Security and other Fatah-linked groups have been battling it out in the streets. People are being killed and injured, including the mutual kidnapping of party members. Former Minister of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Sofiane Abu Zeida of the Fatah party, was one of those kidnapped. The ones who kidnapped me are known. They were known to be from Hamas, and there is no way to doubt that. They were looking for any person that had something to do with Fatah in order to pressure what is now the other side to exchange hostages. It is all painful and saddening because we are fighting over an authority that does not exist, and a land that is still occupied, and privileges that even the president and the prime minister don't have. It is very painful. Thank you, Sofiane Abu Zeida, who, despite having been kidnapped, remembers that the real problem is the occupation. You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps. President Abbas is receiving public moral support from British Prime Minister Tony Blair and even from Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert for being on the moderate side. With us this week to comment on Jordanian support and on the Israeli Prime Minister's public suggestions of support and whether he would carry through or if it would matter right now if he did, is Ahmed Youssef. We did not receive any official letter from Jordan. This has become a big story in the media. But this news is only media hype and nothing more. If Olmert wants to reduce the checkpoints and reduce tension in the Palestinian arena as a positive gesture to President Mahmoud Abbas, then it is good. But our internal situation will not end until both the president and the prime minister meet. Those are the only ones to solve all the internal problems, and if there were an Arab mediation, then those meetings would be out of courtesies only. We only have the option of dialogue. Hamas and Fatah comprise 90% of the electorate, meaning that they are both a majority of the Palestinian people, and they are the ones responsible for ending the differences. Thank you for joining PNN this week, Ahmed Youssef. You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps. Prime Minister Haniyeh said that there is an undeclared decision to topple the government led by the United States and that the internal fighting is playing into the hands of the enemies of the Palestinian people, while he and other Hamas leaders are calling for calm, but few seem to be listening. Government spokesperson from the Hamas party, Ghazi Hamad, was one of those voices calling for an end to the fighting. We are interested for such acts to stop and for there to be a commitment to what has been agreed upon and for no breaches to occur. All we want is peace and security in the Palestinian street. Thank you, government spokesperson Ghazi Hammad, for taking a moment out of this chaotic week to comment. President Abbas had said that the internal ceasefire was in effect and left to meet with Jordan's King Abdullah II on the same day that three Palestinians were killed in the internal fighting. Abd al-Hakim Awad also joined PNN this week to comment on the outcome of internal ceasefire meetings.
I think that the agreement reached late last night was very clear, and we worked hard so that the agreement would be respected and be implemented, because from our last experience, there was no intention for commitment to it. That's why they were not successful. After dawn prayers, crossfire occurred between armed men and the president's guards, and it seems that there are people that want this agreement to fail. The attackers were identified, and the president's guards say they were from the executive force belonging to the Minister of Interior. Abd al-Hakim Awad speaking from Gaza. PNN's Gaza correspondent Wissam Afifa has been reporting from the ground during the internal fighting that began Saturday and commented on some of the effect it is having on the residents of the Gaza Strip. The atmosphere in Gaza is still tense because of the shootings that have occurred in the past few days, leading to the death of eight in the bloody crossfire between the executive force and the president's security force. It is calm now, but the people are still cautious, and education was stopped throughout the strip due to fear that school children might get hurt, especially when the violent incidents reached the schools. Thank you, PNN correspondent Wissam Afifa, reporting from Gaza City. Israel is taking advantage of the current internal upheaval by upping its policy of targeted assassinations with four in just 3 days and major invasions into Kurram, Nablus, and Jenin. PNN's Jenin correspondent Ali Samoudi reports on one of this week's Israeli attacks on the West Bank during the recent increase in assassinations of members of the armed Palestinian resistance. Salah Sawafta and Hussam Aisi became martyrs in an Israeli occupation forces operation in the town of Silat al-Haritha in northern Jenin. The operation began at about 2 a.m. More than 30 military vehicles invaded the town, backed up by helicopters, surrounded houses, and started to raid and search. Inhabitants say that occupation forces overtook a number of houses that overlooked an abandoned house in the town's center. Occupation forces shot at the house with heavy machine guns and demanded that the two surrender. They declined and fought back against the Israeli occupation forces. Then they were assassinated while they were in the surrounded house amidst heavy fire. Occupation forces continued the operation until 9 a.m., continuing the raids and searches of houses to find other resistance members and arrested a number of citizens. Ali Samoudi reporting from the northern West Bank's Jenin. Israeli settlers are returning to a southern Jenin settlement that was part of the withdrawal from Gaza last year that included four Jenin area settlements, while Israeli soldiers are overtaking another for a new military installation. At Jenin's Al Hamra checkpoint this week, hundreds of Palestinians held a spontaneous nonviolent demonstration as seven soldiers beat a student before arresting him. Arrests are still high throughout the West Bank, and Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli Damun prison are on nonviolent hunger strike after the prison administration began denying them family visits. The Palestinians are refusing to be strip searched before the family visits. The Palestinian Prisoner Society is reporting a humanitarian disaster in the Israeli prisons among Palestinian political prisoners due to the lack of medical attention, warm clothes, and justice. You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps. More Palestinian homes are being destroyed in East Jerusalem, and the suburb of Al Ram has now been rezoned out of the capital of the future Palestinian state. The director of mapping in Jerusalem's Arab Studies Society said that the Israeli plan to Judaize the city includes bringing in 100,000 settlers per year.
The Mufti of Jerusalem is calling for international help as the Israeli government is constructing a Western High Bridge at Al-Aqsa Mosque for Israeli soldiers and settlers. Eid al-Adha was called for the 30th of this month, and 800 Palestinians from the northern West Bank began their journey to Mecca to perform the Hajj. And Bethlehem is preparing for Christmas. Despite what the mayor refers to as the Israeli propaganda machine that tells tourists and pilgrims to stay away, the Open Bethlehem Society is also doing its work, having received confirmations from several British clergy to attend services this year at the Church of Nativity. Another UK church is building its own symbolic wall for Christmas this year in solidarity with the people of Bethlehem. The Open Bethlehem campaign also commissioned Zogby to conduct a poll, which indicated that a majority of Americans do not know that Bethlehem is in the occupied West Bank, instead believing that it is an Israeli city inhabited by Jews and Christians. Regardless, the tree was lit as usual on the 15th, with hundreds of Palestinian citizens and officials attending the Manger Square ceremony. Reporting this week in review from the Palestine News Network for the week of the 15th through the 21st of December, I'm Kristen S. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps.
In Berkeley, this is Christopher Brown, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On July 12th, Israeli airstrikes targeted the new Rafik al-Hariri International Airport. Israeli naval vessels entered Lebanon's territorial waters and blocked access to ports while its forces launched an offensive in southern Lebanon against Hezbollah fighters. The Israeli offensive was launched in response to the killing of 8 Israeli soldiers in clashes with Hezbollah fighters near the border, 15 kilometers from the Mediterranean. 2 Israeli soldiers were taken hostage. For 34 days, Israel bombed Lebanon from the air, land, and sea. Hundreds of thousands were displaced from their homes. Over 1,000 Lebanese were killed, and 4 UN workers as well. Although the United States stated that they were behind the Lebanese government of Fawad Sinyora, the U.S. did not demand a call for a ceasefire in the conflict. Even though media coverage was extensive throughout the conflict, continually mainstream media cast the Lebanese as supporters of terrorists and Israelis as long-suffering victims. Currently in Lebanon, there is a new tension in the air calling for the ouster of the Sinyora government. With the recent assassination of Lebanese Industry Minister Pierre Jamil, many in the West, and particularly in the Bush administration, are accusing Syria's involvement in the killing. All of this comes on the heels of more than 1 million cluster bombs that remain scattered on the Lebanese landscape, injuring or killing 13 people a day. Food, clean water, and medicine in short supply, the country's infrastructure in total disarray, and rumors of a potential civil war have only exacerbated an already intolerable situation. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said during the Lebanese-Israeli war that all that was happening was the birth pangs of democracy. Some might regard recent events as a miscarriage instead, a miscarriage of justice. Joining me now to talk more about the current situation in Lebanon is Rania Masri. Rania is a human rights activist and is an assistant professor on the Faculty of Science at the University of Balamand in Lebanon. She is the author of numerous articles and continually speaks to groups on issues concerning Lebanon, Palestine, and Iraq. Rania Masri, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Rania, could you talk to me about the current situation on the ground in Lebanon with regards to the recent protests by Hezbollah supporters calling for the ouster of the Sinyora government?
Well, a few comments, if I may. It is quite typical, I have to say, of the way the Western media has been presenting this demonstration. This is why it continues to be presented in this way, as if it is a demonstration of Hezbollah supporters. And that is not quite accurate. The demonstrations, by the way, that have included more than half the population of Lebanon, so more than half the population of Lebanon have actually come out to these demonstrations, are not simply Hezbollah supporters. Hezbollah is the main party, but there also is the Free Patriotic Movement led by Christian General Michel Aoun, as well as the Communist Party, the Syrian Nationalist Party, the Amal Movement, the Workers' Movement. There's a whole range of organizations and political parties from the left, from the secular, from the nationalist. I mean, a real coalition in the full sense of the word. To simply present them as Hezbollah supporters does them a great deal of injustice. So just to get that straightened out and placed into perspective. To go back as to what you're saying with regards to of the mood of the country, what I find to be particularly ironic is that the way the mood of the country is being presented again in the West. I mean, what happened last year was we had a coalition being formed that was particularly representing the right, but nevertheless, a coalition was formed across different religious sectors, across several different political parties, in which almost half the Lebanese population took part in some of the protests. The protests were colorful, they were peaceful, they also called for a change of government, and these protests were presented by the West as being democratic. They were being labeled as the Cedar Revolution. They were hailed as beautiful symbols of democracy. Now we have demonstrations in which a larger groups of people have participated in which there's actually a larger coalition representing a more significant array of the population, in which the demonstrations have arguably been more peaceful than they have previously last year, in which there actually is less incitement committed by these coalition organizers than there was done by last year's coalition organizers, and in which the demand is even less than the demand was last year. Last year, the demand was actually, when they started protesting, they actually did succeed in bringing down the government. This year, the protesters are not even calling for a political coup. They're not calling for a new government. They're calling for governmental partnership and a government of national unity. And yet, these protesters are being presented in the West as being beacons of tension, as being beacons of strife. And now there's possible statements of a civil war that is looming. It's quite ironic. You know, very much of the same tactics are being practiced, very similar tactics. And yet in one perspective, we have it represented as being democratic. And another perspective, we have these current demonstrators being presented as being wanting a coup, foreign supporters, and these rumors of a civil war, which I personally find to be unfounded.
You know, I find it very interesting you bring up that statement of a civil war. Here in the West, we're always talking about, oh, there's a potential civil war that's going to happen in Lebanon. There's a potential civil war that's going to happen in Palestine. We never seem to be mentioning that when we talk about Iraq, though. No, that's not a civil war. That's not a civil war, when clearly it is. It's interesting how they decide where is a civil war conflict happening and where it's not.
Yeah, but even in Iraq, Chris, I would argue in Iraq we do not have a civil war that is looming. And I have heard American leaders refer to Iraq as civil war, but that again would be grossly simplistic. In Iraq, we have the consequences of a brutal occupation. Had it not been for the U.S. occupation in Iraq, had it not been for also the deliberate, corrupt negligence of American corporations failing to even fulfill their promises for American taxpayers in rebuilding Iraqi infrastructure and therefore exacerbating the lack of infrastructure and the problems of economic inequity that were born out of the sanctions and born out of the occupation, we would not have the problems we right now have in Iraq. So the blame I present fully and completely on the shoulders of the U.S. occupying forces.
That is the voice of Rania Masri, an assistant professor at the University of Belmont in Lebanon. Rania, I wanted to ask you, of course, we were branding about that Syria must be involved in the assassination mm-hmm. of the industry minister, Pierre Jamail. Mm-hmm. And of course, at this point, we have absolutely no idea who probably carried out this kind of assassination, do we?
Well, I find this to be quite ironic that the Lebanese government is inept to even figure out who killed, Minister Pierre Jamail when he was killed in broad daylight on a public street with gunfire in a very mafia-style kind of killing. And it reminds me of an incident that happened during on December 1st, which was the first day of the opposition's beautiful protest. And I just want to make this comment for people to get a sense of the size of these protests. Back in February 2003, when we had the historic anti-war protest around the world, and in New York City, I remember we were 750,000 people in New York City, and we were approximately 10 to 15 million people in the world. And the New York Times hailed the anti-war movement as being the second global power. And it was huge. Okay. Now, if we want to keep those numbers into perspective and look at the numbers in Lebanon, we are talking about a population of 4 million people in Lebanon. And the protest on December 1st, according to CNN, comprised at least 1.3 million people on the streets. So that's 1.3 million people on the streets in one locality from around the country in a population of 4 million. That is historic. In this protest, there was a gentleman who lost his wallet. In this protest, they managed to retrieve his wallet, all the money in it, within 4 hours.
Wow.
So the question then remains, if they managed to retrieve a wallet within 4 hours in a protest of more than 1 million people, how could the Lebanese government still till now not have managed to retrieve the bullet casings from the assassination of Pierre Ismail when he was assassinated in broad daylight on a public street? And they have not been able to manage to find the bullet casings. So there's a lot of questions as to the assassinations of Pierre Ismail, and I find it to be a naive and simplistic knee-jerk reaction of people who are hell-bent on attacking Syria to simply place the Syrian government responsible for this murder. They have nothing politically to gain. I actually argue they have a lot politically to lose from his murder. And the bigger question should be on the grotesque inefficiency of the Lebanese government, one, to protect its own ministers, and more powerfully, two, to be able to gather any basic shreds of evidence from this arguably public assassination.
Rania, on that same note, in regards to the assassination, I want to bring in another potential scenario. We've known now for well over a year that Israel was planning on this incursion into Lebanon, basically starting this war. As a matter of fact, they had gone to the White House and said, here's what we're going to do. Actually, certain journalists knew about it. They said nothing, of course, but they knew about it. And they were just waiting for their pretext to go ahead and decide, okay, this is our time. And they used the excuse of these 8 soldiers being killed and these 2 soldiers being captured and what have you. Throughout this time, obviously, a lot of misinformation was being bandied about, of saying, well, you know, we're doing this because we're trying to stop a greater potential threat, not only from Hezbollah, but also from Syria, who is supplying Hezbollah with all of their munitions. Could it possibly be that this war with Lebanon be used as a pretext to go ahead and attack Syria, saying, well, you know, we need to stop these terrorist states from doing what they're doing?
It very much could be presented as a pretext. One could also look at it as a blueprint to the rumblings that the neoconservative Bush government has been having against Iran, in the sense that if Israel would have been successful in destroying Hezbollah, which they completely failed to do, both militarily and socially in the country, in Lebanon, then possibly the U.S. could be successful in destroying the Iranian military capability. But I want to make just one comment here. For the listeners out there who do believe that Hezbollah is a threat in some way or fashion to the state of Israel, and who do want to see Hezbollah disarmed, it is amazingly easy to disarm Hezbollah, just as it is amazingly easy to disarm Palestinian suicide fighters and Palestinian militias. Amazingly easy. And that is remove the reasons that Hezbollah has weaponry. And the reasons that Hezbollah is armed is because since 1978, Israel has been occupying portions of Lebanon. It is because of Hezbollah's fighting that the Lebanese managed to retrieve the majority of the Lebanese land that was occupied by the Israelis, resulting in the Israelis leaving the majority, not all, of the Lebanese lands in 2000. Israel continues to occupy Lebanese lands. Israel continues to invade Lebanese territories, both air, by land, and by sea. This practice continues to happen. And it was happening on a regular basis before the July war, and it's still happening. So if we want an organization, a militia, call it what you may, to be disarmed, the only way to do that is by removing the reasons that it is armed. And the reason that Hezbollah is armed is because Israel has proved itself since 1948 to be a threat to the Lebanese population. Remove that sense of a threat. Remove that itself, which does not mean remove the state of Israel. It means to remove that threat of military aggression, and you remove the reasons for Hezbollah to be armed. The same thing applies to the Palestinian territories and the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, and you end the retaliatory acts of Palestinian self-defense and Palestinian violence.
That is the voice of Rania Masri, human rights activist based in Lebanon. Rania, let's look at it from this perspective, if we can. Now, many here in the West are critical of Hezbollah, as they say, hiding out among civilians while they were fighting the Israelis. They said that, well, you know, you're using the Lebanese as a human shield. This is just an abomination and what have you. Then all of a sudden we come out with an Amnesty International report that says the same thing, that you can't afford to do that. But at the same time, at least to their credit to an extent, Amnesty International as well as Human Rights Watch stated that, in fact, Israel still had no right to bomb those civilian areas, regardless of whether there was one Hezbollah fighter or 20 in that area. Yet that part of the report was suppressed here in the West. Why do you think this is?
Well, I mean, the reason is very clear. It's the same reason that Jimmy Carter's book has been attacked vociferously by numerous Western media outlets and by arguing all aspects of U.S. corporate media. It's because the truth is quite dangerous in the United States, and the truth, especially when it touches upon the Zionist state of Israel, is not welcome and it's completely banned. But I would argue that the truth is, you know, being banned in the United States is not simply about the Zionist state of Israel, but it's about numerous issues of justice, be it economic justice, social justice, or political justice. Now, to go back to the specific point, I think people have a false understanding as to the organization of Hezbollah and as to the makeup of South Lebanon. Hezbollah is a movement of the people, by the people, fully so. To be able to think of it that these men who are literally fighting for their land have no right to be on that land is immoral and it's unethical and it's also illegal. The whole construct is a false question. Hezbollah fighters have every right to be anywhere they want within the Lebanese territory. This is their home. These are their villages. They are there defending these areas from the invading Israeli army. Had they not been there, the Israeli army would have continued to invade. Were it not for the presence of Hezbollah fighters where they were in the south, the Israeli army would have invaded and would have occupied and reoccupied those areas. So to place Hezbollah fighters as being responsible for the attack on Lebanese soil, it makes no sense whatsoever. It's akin to placing a rape victim responsible for her rape because she was fighting it. And had she not been fighting it, then her rapist might not have attacked her as brutally. It is that equivalence. The responsibility falls full blame, no question, on the state of Israel for their attacks. And if we still question it, then all we have to do is ask the Israeli government why they chose, after agreeing to a ceasefire, after agreeing to a halt, 2 days before that, knowing that an agreement to a ceasefire was coming to play, knowing that politically it was done, they nevertheless for a two-day extension. And within those 2 days, that was when they littered the southern areas of Lebanon with cluster bombs. And we are talking about cluster bombs that are still killing people, cluster bombs that have filled agricultural fields, that have made it literally life-threatening for farmers to cultivate their fields. Why would a government choose to do this were it not hell-bent on revenge? This is not an act of self-defense by the state of Israel. This was purely an act of aggression and revenge, and I would argue even hatred. So if we're going to place things in context, let's place things in full context. The responsibility falls on the shoulders of the Israeli government, on the shoulders of the Israeli army, and more so on the shoulders of the neoconservative agenda in the United States that funded this army, that diplomatically supported this army, and that continues to support these practices of aggression and state terrorism.
Rania, it's good that you brought up the issue of cluster bombs. I find it rather ironic that throughout the entire conflict, both Israel and the United States, as well as Great Britain, were constantly saying, well, Syria is arming Hezbollah, Syria is arming Hezbollah. Why was there no mention of the U.S. arming Israel with F-16s, with arming Israel with M-16s, with arming Israel with cluster bomb munitions that have literally scattered the southern landscape, as you said, in Lebanon during, ironically, just before the olive harvest, which is one of the most crucial things that happened. I lived in the Middle East for more than 4 years. I understand how important the olive harvest is for a lot of farmers, and they could not even go out into their fields because they were literally just blanketed with these cluster bombs. Why not have any kind of a discussion in regards to what the U.S. has supplied in order to rain hell on the Lebanese people?
Exactly. Very well said. And why not also speak about the Lebanese victims of these wars? And we had, in this war specifically, the vast majority of Lebanese that were civilians, 30% of whom were children. And yet there are still American reports in the Washington Post, the Washington Times, and the New York Times that speak of more than 1,000 people killed in Lebanon and Israel, as if there were an equal number of victims on both sides. And the victim number was not equal, neither in number nor in the specific attacks. The vast majority of Israelis killed were soldiers. The vast majority of Lebanese killed were civilians. On top of that, the number is vastly different. So, you know, it just brings to mind these issues of racism and whose lives actually are deemed worthy of discussion by the U.S. media and whose lives are deemed worthless. And it's not an issue even if they die. Just as it were not an issue in U.S. media when we had more than 5,000 Iraqi children being killed every month by sanctions, and it was regarded by the U.S. media as not being newsworthy that Iraqi children were being killed. Just as it is regarded by the U.S. news media as not being newsworthy that Palestinian youth are continuing to be killed every single day in the occupied territories at the behest of Israeli occupying soldiers.
It's interesting that you bring up in regards to the Palestinian children throughout the entire 34-day incursion. Nothing, as you say, was mentioned about Palestinians and the plight that was happening in Gaza, supposedly to retrieve one soldier and just unleashing hell on all of Gaza for a foreseeable point of time. And nothing was said about that. And even as you said, within the Lebanon war, Lebanon-Israeli war, still, it was always, like I said in my introduction, it was the long-suffering situation of the Israelis, of just wanting to live in peace. It was the long-suffering of the Israeli soldiers bravely going into southern Lebanon and trying to battle these terrorists and what have you.
Exactly.
But as you said, it's a grassroots movement. They left with their tail between their legs. And yet we didn't get that perspective from CNN. We didn't get it from MSNBC. We didn't get it from ABC. We got it from Democracy Now!, but Amy Goodman can only do so much. I can only do so much. Flashpoints Radio and the like can only do so much. How can we go further to be able to bring about what is really happening on the ground in places such as Lebanon?
Well, there's a great deal of awareness that needs to happen, and it starts out through grassroots awareness. I mean, through public lectures, through people understanding that the media in the United States is grotesquely subjective. And we know for a fact the media lies to us about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And my big question to people is, if we know that the media is lying about one thing, then what certainty do we have that the media is not lying about everything? I mean, if the media lies to us about one aspect of foreign policy, how do we know they're not lying to us about all aspects of foreign policy and arguably even domestic policy? So it becomes the responsibility of American citizens, if they want to continue to live and struggle for a sense of democracy in the United States, which is a whole other issue, then they have to take responsibility for their education, which I understand is a very, very difficult thing, because there's a significant portion of the American public that does not even have the time to do this because they have to carry two jobs just to make a living and just to make ends meet. So for those people who actually do have the time, the responsibility becomes in reading international newspapers, in reading European newspapers, in reading books, and reading, you know, Noam Chomsky, and reading real strong analyses, and actually also having discussions and being able to be wiser consumers of U.S. corporate media and being able to scuffle through the dirt to be able to get through the gems of the news, being able to understand that the big context we have in the Palestinian-Israeli struggle is that we have land that is occupied. And that has to be the basic foundation for everything else. That has to be the understanding, that we have an occupied land here. We have people who are struggling for basic rights, and an army that has no right, legally or morally, to be on that property, to be in that area, to be invading people's homes. That has to be the context through which people, you know, look at these things. So, to answer your question, there has to be a lot of grassroots activism in the United States, and there is that. There's a wonderful array of local and regional and national organizations in the United States that do good work in distributing the news, be them U.S.-based or be them, you know, issue-based organizations. And then, as well, there's an array of information from international newspapers to good internet sites such as the angryarab.blogspot.com site, as well as to really good books such as Noam Chomsky and Edward Said, and a range of others as well.
And we're going to have to leave it there. I've been speaking to Rania Masri, assistant professor on the Faculty of Science at the University of Balamon in Lebanon. Rania, thank you so much for coming on Crossing the Line today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم عم يتساءلون عن النبأ العظيم الذي هم فيه مختلفون كلا سيعلمون ثم كلا سيعلمون ألم نجعل الأرض مهادا والجبال أوتادا وخلقناكم أزواجا وجعلنا نومكم سباتا وجعلنا الليل لباسا وجعلنا النهار معاشا وبنينا فوقكم سبعا شدادا وجعلنا سراجا وهاجا وأنزلنا من المعصرات ماء ثجاجا لنخرج به حبا ونباتا وجنات ألفافا إن يوم الفصل كان ميقاتا يوم ينفخ في الصور فتأتون أفواجا وفتحت السماء فكانت أبوابا وسيرت الجبال فكانت سرابا إن جهنم كانت مرصادا للطاغين مآبا لابثين فيها أحقابا لا يذوقون فيها بردا ولا شرابا إلا حميما وغساقا جزاء وفاقا إنهم كانوا لا يرجون حسابا وكذبوا بآياتنا كذابا وكل شيء أحصيناه كتابا فذوقوا فلن نزيدكم إلا عذابا إن للمتقين مفازا حدائق وأعنابا وكواعب أترابا وكأسا دهاقا لا يسمعون فيها لغوا ولا كذابا جزاء من ربك عطاء حسابا رب السماوات والأرض وما بينهما الرحمن لا يملكون منه خطابا يوم يقوم الروح والملائكة صفا لا يتكلمون إلا من أذن له الرحمن وقال صوابا ذلك اليوم الحق فمن شاء اتخذ إلى ربه مآبا إنا أنذرناكم عذابا قريبا يوم ينظر المرء ما قدمت يداه يوم ينظر المرء ما قدمت يداه ويقول الكافر يا ليتني كنت ترابا.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist who chronicles the human condition. He has been a resident of Pennsylvania's death row for 23 years. Writing from his solitary confinement cell, his essays have reached a worldwide audience. His books, Live from Death Row, Death Blossoms, All Things Censored, Faith of Our Fathers, and the recently released We Want Freedom, have sold over 150,000 copies and have been translated into 7 languages. His 1982 murder trial and subsequent conviction have been the subject of great debate.
When war crimes ain't war crimes. In the last few years, we've all seen nothing but mass violations of virtually every international human rights treaty, torture, secret prisons, extraordinary rendition, violence against civilians, orders to ignore the Geneva Conventions. The list goes on and on. How has the American government dealt with this state of affairs? It has virtually ignored it. There have been a few military prosecutions against relatively low-level people, but there is a steel ceiling above which the prosecutors dare not go. That's because the violations of international law go to the highest levels of the U.S. government. Writer Leela Rajiva argues in her remarkable The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib and the American Media, that the tortures at Abu Ghraib prison on the outskirts of Baghdad show something deep and ugly in the American state. She writes, "The Prometheans of today acknowledge no limits except of their own imagining, and at least for now, the world that they find themselves in allows them the self-indulgence of that imagining. With such absolute power comes absolute corruption, only not the corruption that the law easily unmasks, the simple corruption of bribery and chicanery. The occupation of Iraq displays ample evidence of that as well. But the deeper corruption that rots the institutions of America today is one legitimated by law, whose presence is revealed not in the courthouse, but in the solitary recesses of prison cells hidden from the light. Torture is the insignia of this corrupt power. Torture is the deadly proof of the metastasizing cancer of American empire." Rajiva tells us many of the stories from Iraq that have been largely whitewashed from the safe coverage that the corporate media airs. She tells us the many cases where Iraqi women were raped by Americans and subjected to public humiliations. Perhaps if more Americans read, saw, or heard such accounts, they would not be mystified by the steady growing of the insurgency in Iraq, which is surely fueled in part by how Americans treated Iraqi men and women in prisons there. The corporate U.S. media has done more to misinform its public than to inform them. They keep Americans in the dark, while people all around the world know more about America than Americans. In this context, we can continue the illusion that the U.S. is doing good in this new kind of colonialism of Arab lands. It is this mad disinformation campaign that allows political figures to float the mad idea of more troops in Iraq. The somewhat tame Iraq Study Group report has come and gone, with supporters of the military-industrial complex working their media assets to ensure that their defense contractors keep getting paid. Discussions over Geneva Conventions might as well be about treaties with space aliens, as arcane as they are to most of us. When it comes to the empire, there is no higher law. The emperor has spoken. That is all that is needed to launch wars, torture, terrorize, bomb, imprison, kill, obliterate. That kind of logic can only lead to more disaster. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
The War's Toll, for the 7 days through December 19th, 2006. I'll be reading the names of U.S. and coalition soldiers who have been reported killed in the past week in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'll also be reading the names of some Iraqi civilians. These civilians were reported killed on March 25th, 2003, just 6 days into the invasion. But first, the numbers. As of this morning, December 20th, 2006, 3,201 coalition soldiers have been killed in Iraq. Of that number, 2,954 are U.S. soldiers. The Department of Defense reports that 22,401 U.S. soldiers have been wounded. They also report that 46,880 have suffered quote-unquote non-mortal casualties. Also, 377 private contractors have been reported killed in Iraq. These private contractors of various nationalities. I also will note that there is no information to date on casualties, that's wounded casualties of soldiers from other nationalities other than the United States. In this past week, then, 17 U.S. and coalition soldiers were reported killed in Iraq. In Afghanistan, 515 coalition soldiers have been reported killed since the invasion, October 2001. Of that number, 357 are U.S. soldiers. Department of Defense reports that 1,062 U.S. soldiers have been wounded. They also report that 5,994 have suffered what are called quote-unquote, non-mortal wounds. In the past week, then, one coalition soldier was reported killed in Afghanistan. Also, at least 55 Afghanis were killed in the past week, according to iCasualties.org, bringing the total in December of 2006 to at least 235. Back to Iraq, according to IraqBodyCount.org, 56,533 Iraqi civilians have been killed since the invasion in March of 2003. However, we'll note that the John Hopkins study reported in the Lancet Journal in the United Kingdom just a few weeks ago estimated that 650,000 Iraqi civilians have died since the invasion. That would put the number of wounded Iraqis in the hundreds of thousands, if not over a million. In the past week, at least 319 Iraqis have been killed, bringing the total in December of 2006 to at least 1,094. The financial cost of the war, according to costofwar.com, is at $351.7 billion and counting. For taxpayers in Maryland, your tax bill is at $6.8 billion and counting. This is all due to from costofwar.com and is only for the Iraq War. I will now read the names of some Iraqi civilians who were reported killed again on the 25th of March of 2003. Malik Hussein Rafif, unknown aged male. Marwah Khalel Salman, 17-year-old girl. Methak Aloui Rithede Asade, 27-year-old man. Mahmed Taham Gassem, 6-year-old boy. Mahmed Esser Yusuf Al-Ghabre, 63-year-old man. Mahmed Gaber Keber Al-Nabi, 35-year-old man. Mahmed Kathem Abid Hashem, 4-year-old boy. Ahmed Taha Nasser Abdre, 8-year-old boy. Mahand Glel Munz Azadeh, 21-year-old man. Narklel Yonis Azde, 14-year-old girl. I will now read the names of one U.S. soldier reported killed in Afghanistan in the past week. On the 16th of December, Joseph E. Fanuf II, 38 years old, U.S. Army National Guard, Eastford, Connecticut. I will now read the names of U.S. and coalition soldiers reported killed in Iraq in the past 7 days. On the 10th of December, Nicholas P. Steinbacher, 22 years old, U.S. Army, La Crescenta, California. Also on the 10th of December, Philip C. Ford, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Freeport, Texas. Also on the 10th of December, Sean M. Murphy, 24 years old, U.S. Army, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. On the 11th of December, Brian P. McAnulty, 39 years old, U.S. Marine, Vicksburg, Mississippi. On the 12th of December, Brent W. Dunkelberger, 29 years old, U.S. Army, Bloomfield, Pennsylvania. Also on the 12th of December, Gloria D. Davis, 47 years old, U.S. Army, St. Louis, Missouri. On the 14th of December, Matthew W. Clark, U.S. Marine, 22 years old, St. Louis, Missouri. Also on the 14th of December, Luke C. Yepsen, 20 years old, U.S. Marine, Kingwood, Texas. Also on the 14th of December, Theodore A. Spettle, 59 years old, U.S. Army, Thermopolis, Wyoming. On the 15th of December, Paul Ballant, Jr., 22 years old, U.S. Army, Willow Park, Texas. Also on the 15th of December, Henry K. Kahalawai, 43 years old, U.S. Army, Hilo, Hawaii. On the 16th of December, Matthew J. Stanley, 22 years old, U.S. Army, Wolfboro Falls, New Hampshire. Also on the 16th of December, David R. Statz, 30 years old, U.S. Army, Pueblo, Colorado. Also on the 16th of December, Joe L. Baines, 19 years old, U.S. Army, Newark, New Jersey. And also on the 16th of December, Nick J. Palmer, 19 years old, U.S. Marine, Leadville, Colorado. On the 18th of December, Kevin M. Christ, 27 years old, U.S. Marine, West Bend, Wisconsin. On the 19th of December, Seth M. Stanton, 19 years old, U.S. Army, Colorado Springs, Colorado. This has been The War's Toll for the 7 days through the 19th of December, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin with the Stand Independent News Service. As always, our hearts go out to the fallen, their loved ones, their relatives and neighbors in all countries.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer Kristen S. and associate producer Scott Berguin for their invaluable contributions to this program. From all of us here at Crossing the Line, we wish you and yours a safe and happy holidays and peace and prosperity for the new year. In Berkeley, this is Christopher Brown for Crossing the Line, signing off.